getting the city's homeless off the streets and into jobs. That conversation's just ahead. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in on this Monday. Hope your work week's off to a good start. I'm Melissa Ross, and keep listening because just ahead, we're going to have a look at this week's point in time count. That's a snapshot of the homeless situation in Northeast Florida and what's being done about it. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, Culpepper says he's had enough of all the Deflategate talk. He'll have some other thoughts about this weekend's Super Bowl. Plus, author Tess Gerritsen and today's First Coast Success profiles Nina Waters. All of that ahead. But first this morning, a school teacher from Orlando got a lot of attention last week around town. Thomas Redmond took a year off from his job teaching kids to live as a homeless person in cities around Florida. We caught up with him the other day in downtown Hemming Park as he explained what he's doing.
I'm exactly the same as any other homeless person, except I'm doing it voluntary, and I know I can leave at any time. That's true. So I don't have the real emotional problems that they do as far as not knowing when it's ever going to end. Other than that, I have every problem they have. I have to find something to eat. You know, I have to try to get work to get money. The exact same problems. You know, the homeless are actually, they're, you know, 40% are families. 20% of them are veterans. And we have some real great people that are on the street. You wouldn't even know they're homeless if you saw them. So the stigma of homelessness, of being those vagrants, is what I'm trying to get across. And the reason I keep doing it is it's working. It's just very, very difficult. In Orlando, I applied for 150 plus jobs in 30 days and couldn't get any job. And the reason is not that people are against the homeless. It's because if you have a number of job applications, you're going to pick the best candidate as an employer. And when you see homeless on the application, that's not your best candidate.
Redmond says he's meeting with Florida Governor Rick Scott's Council on Homelessness next month to share his experiences living on the streets and his insights into what he thinks should be done to address the issue. At the same time, local volunteers are going to be very busy this week with another important effort. It's called the Point in Time Homeless Count. Now, every year, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, requires counties that receive funding for homeless services to conduct a survey of people living on the streets. That's going to happen this Wednesday in Duval, Clay, and Nassau counties. But it's more than just a head count. The idea is to use the information to reduce the number of homeless people in our area by getting them into housing and jobs. That's an effort that's been going on for a while. And here with an update, we're pleased to welcome Don Gilman, the president of the Emergency Services and Homeless Coalition of Northeast Florida. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you on the show. And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about solutions when it comes to addressing the issue of homelessness on the First Coast? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/FirstCoastConnect email and tweet the show. And we also welcome your Facebook comments. So that school teacher, Thomas Redmond, trying to dramatize what it's like for a homeless person. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's I'm of two minds of that. He did come to Jacksonville really not knowing anything about our community. He had spent, I believe, 30 days homeless in Orlando. He was in Jacksonville for about 4 or 5 days. To my knowledge, he did not spend a night in any of the shelters here. I believe he did access several of the different food lines. And he did post quite regularly on his Facebook page about what he saw. It did dramatize the fact, which all of us who work to assist the homeless already knew, is we have a large, what we call an unsheltered homeless population. That's people who either cannot or will not access our emergency shelters and are out on the streets. They're who most citizens would usually think of as when you say the word homeless.
And we want your calls as we talk about this week's Point in Time Count, a survey of homelessness on the First Coast, 549-2937. So tell us about the Point in Time Count, Dawn.
Sure. We've been doing this for over a decade. It is mandated by HUD. It is a snapshot, so we can kind of look at how we are doing in a broad scope. In the last several years, We have seen a decrease in two what we call subpopulations. One is veterans, and the other one is chronically homeless. I will say, last year it looked like we were doing an amazing job, but if anyone remembers the last 10 days of January last year, it was about 19 degrees the evening that we did the point in time count. We did not want to find any unsheltered persons. We were hoping that they had found a place to go into. This year is going to be a really good baseline for us to see how much our efforts have worked to reduce homelessness.
And let's talk about that, because as that school teacher told local reporters, the idea isn't just to raise awareness. The idea is to go from awareness to action and actually getting people into shelter, into employment. And mm-hmm. as he said, he made the point that he sent out job applications, but when you have no permanent address, nobody will give you a job. And so you've been very much engaged in that. There's even an initiative called 016. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. 02016 is something we have signed up for, saying that we as a community have committed to reach what is called functional zero for veteran homelessness by December 31st of 2015, and the same functional zero for chronic homelessness of 2016. That means we have the goal to reduce the total number of homelessness down to there's always going to be an inflow, but that inflow will be small enough that we can deal and help those people within 30 days. So part of that, as you mentioned at the top of the show, is jobs. There is a large segment of the homeless population that is able and willing to work. But once you do fall into homelessness, as mentioned, it can be difficult to obtain employment. Part of our effort is to coordinate. There's a lot of different efforts within our community to help employ people who are at a disadvantage. But how do we get a person to the right program for them? Or if they have recently worked, how do we just get them to an agency that their job is to find jobs for other people and get them employed and back on their feet and not needing to access any of the services that we do have?
So, and it's not just employment, it's also housing, isn't it?
Correct. There's been recent reports out. There is no county left in the United States where you can work at minimum wage for 40 hours a week and afford housing. So affordable housing is a big issue, not just in Northeast Florida, but throughout most of the country. There are different pockets where it's more difficult in our area. Specifically in Nassau County, it can be more difficult to find truly affordable housing. We have been fortunate in Duval to try to develop more affordable housing in different areas. In our definition, affordable housing means something that the household can pay 30% less or less of their income monthly to maintain that housing. So it's for someone who's on a fixed income or Social Security disability, that does become very challenging.
But you have had some success putting together affordable housing units for people. Can you tell us where that stands?
Sure. A lot of the affordable housing that we have in the three-county area is called scattered site housing, which means we get funding from HUD to help subsidize market rate apartments. The benefit of that is the people can go out and they can live in the community that they're from, where their families are, where they know how to get transportation and maybe already have a job in the area. We have also had some success in developing more, I guess you would call them apartment buildings or multi-family, multi-residential sites. Those are much more expensive upfront because you're building from the ground up or rehabbing an existing place. But the benefit to that is the agency that develops it then owns that apartment complex and can keep the rents very affordable.
How many people would you estimate you've moved from the streets into these types of units?
Well, there's two, the permanent supportive housing or permanent housing, we've probably moved since April 1st about 60 to 70 different households that are the most critically acute. Part of this whole process for 02016, it isn't just hoping that we reach it. It's actually very data-driven and trying to find out who is on the street. When I say most acute, who is the most medically vulnerable, moving them to the top of the list for the next available apartment or unit so they can get off the street and begin to stabilize medically and hopefully emotionally as they move forward.
And that brings us to your point in time count. That's coming up Wednesday,
yes.
And you have lots of volunteers signed up, but you need a few more.
We could use a few more. The point in time count is our big volunteer event in downtown Jacksonville, San Marco, and the Riverside area. We will be going out very early in the morning. We found the more urban concentrated the area is, we need to get out before everybody starts moving around. For the rest of Duval, Clay, and Nassau County, we'll be doing that in the afternoons.
And in a moment, we'll tell you how you can join that effort. And as we discuss this week's Point in Time Count, a survey of people living on the streets in Northeast Florida, what are your thoughts and questions about the efforts to reduce homelessness here on the First Coast? 549-2937 to join the show. Richard in Northwest Jacksonville. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I had to call. Normally, I just listen, but, and I'll just total disclosure, I'm a candidate for City Council District 7, first off.
Oh, okay.
But one of the things that made me call and not just listen is when I moved to Jacksonville in 1990, I literally moved with the thing I owned, the trunk of my cousin's car, and 4 months later was on the street homeless.
Oh, wow.
Now, I fit all those categories. I was a veteran. I was homeless. But it was only for a day because I had a strong management background. When I was in Miami, I was able to walk into a job right in the community where I ended up getting back on my feet and ended up back in radio and successful business and all those other things. But had I not been able to make that one little move, there's no telling where I would be in my life. And I'm listening to your guest speak, and everything that she is saying is exactly what we need to do to address the problem. And I'm telling you, sign me up. I will be there Wednesday helping you to count and doing whatever I can do. And that's not from a political standpoint. That's just because it's my life. And I believe anybody that can get a helping hand. And let me say this. I think Denise Lee was on your show a little while ago talking about blighted homes.
Yeah.
We need to stop talking about tearing down blighted homes and find a way to put life into those homes. And this is a way that we can do it without having to build a multi-million-dollar apartment complex.
Thanks so much. It's Richard on the Northwest side. Don Gilman.
Yes, Richard, thank you very much. If you are on Facebook, that's the easiest way to find the link to sign up. It's just find us under Emergency Services and Homeless Coalition of Northeast Florida. And there is a link to sign up. I think it's important what Richard said is homelessness is not just a downtown issue. We break all three counties up into multiple zones. We will find homeless persons in every part of our county, from the most rural to the most urban. It happens to be more visible downtown, but that does not mean it does not exist in other parts of the county.
Sure, there are camps all over and pockets of homelessness all over the area.
Absolutely. And it's also important to mention there is one subgroup that really is not captured fully with this point in time count, and that's families with minor children. Florida is leading the pack in this very unfortunate phenomenon. Families with minor children often are doing something called couch surfing, where they can spend a couple nights on their aunt's couch, maybe a friend will take them in, but they are still not stably housed. This is a really tough nut to crack. We mentioned Zero 2016. As we're sprinting towards that goal, we are trying to figure out how do we reach the goal of Zero 2020, which is families and youth, and getting that population really down, figuring out how do we help them be stably housed. That's the best for the kids. That's the best for the families.
549-2937 to join the show. Let's go to Noel in Jacksonville. Hi, Noel. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
In the mid-1970s, I was an auditor for the New York State Department of Audit and Control. And as a field auditor, we had to go out and audit some of these methadone clinics. And I was very impressed with their operation because if a person came in, now I realize we're talking about a heroin addict here, but if they came in, they could give any name. They're asked a series of questions. Do you want to get cleaned up? If they say yes, go to room one. Do you need a job? If they say yes, go to room two. Do you need a place to live? Go to room three. It was like a one stop for all social services areas to care of the person. And I realized in New York State, we had New York State income tax. They still do. But still in all, the social cost of homelessness, just the medical cost alone, must be very, very large. They ever considered having a program here, only not for methadone per se, just for homeless people to come in and help them out. We definitely have a very high rate of apartment vacancies in this city compared to something like New York. And I'll take my answer on.
Yeah, thanks. So thanks for the call, Noel. It's always interesting when we get calls from people who've seen how this mm-hmm. plays out in another city and just their reactions to the particulars of what's going on in Jacksonville.
Yeah, and let me address, I think there are about three different things that Noel brought off. One is coordinated intake assessment and referral. The second is the cost, the medical cost, specifically to the entire community, and also apartment vacancies. The first one, Noel, we are not where New York State is. We are working and have launched coordinated intake assessment and referral. That is moving us more towards that one-stop shop. That's part of that prioritization, making sure that the people that are the most vulnerable are prioritized for the services that are available first. The second thing that you mentioned was the high medical cost. Absolutely. When you are on the street, any sort of chronic illness that normally could be dealt with in a home becomes exacerbated. One thing in particular that people forget about is if you're a diabetic. If you're on the street, you don't have a refrigerator. If you don't have a refrigerator, you can't keep your insulin safe. That can cause a lot of issues and will probably cause you to end up in an emergency room, which is the most expensive way to deal with a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
On the high apartment vacancy rates, they are high, but for most market rent apartments, you have to have some sort of income or be able to demonstrate that you'll be able to continue to pay throughout that 1 year lease. For someone that is just coming off the streets, we need to be able to get that subsidy or have an available subsidy to them so they can demonstrate that. And then again, help them get an ongoing income to maintain that apartment by themselves.
Let's go to CJ in San Marco now. Hey, CJ, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thank you. I just had a quick solution, possibly. I know the city of Jacksonville has a big inventory of homes that have been seized or foreclosed on due to them failing to pay property taxes or bank-owned homes and things like that. Possibly there may be a good solution to be able to try to get people into those homes because they're just sitting there vacant and they're driving other nearby homeowners' property down because the lawn's not getting mowed and stuff like that. So actually get people that need it, like families, into homes. That's a possibility. But this is just another example of why things like free community college, someone can get 2 years, to get these people job training. They definitely want to get a leg up, and I think that we as a society, it's the right thing to do, but it's also the most cost-effective thing to do to be able to help people get a leg up in society. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, CJ. And that comes up a lot. It seems like that would be a really obvious solution. It's probably a little more complicated, I'm guessing you're going to say, than it might appear at first blush.
It is. I have learned more about mortgages and foreclosures and legal title than most I thought I would in a nonprofit area. I believe that Councilperson Gulliford is also exploring this on a countywide basis on how can the city legally take possession of some of these houses. And without getting into the weeds on this, Florida also led the pack in bank foreclosures.
Right. So here we are with the highest volume of foreclosed properties in the nation
mm-hmm.
and the highest percentage of women with minor children on the streets or couch surfing.
Yep.
How can we put those two together?
Part of the problem is getting legal title to those homes. And this may be another totally different topic for yours, but there's a phenomenon called zombie mortgages out there
right,
in Florida
right
now. So
yeah.
it's there's a fight. No one really wants the house anymore, so no one really owns the house anymore. So you, to move a family into that house, it could be booted out at any time.
Yeah, it's in legal limbo. But we have seen, anecdotally heard about, squatters. Mm-hmm. People just kind of, they see an empty house and they squat.
They do, and sometimes they take care of it, and sometimes it's bad for the entire neighborhood.
Yeah. Let's go now to Steve in Jacksonville, and the number to join us, 549-2937. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Peter, not Steve. My question is, what step do you have in process right now for a person who is not homeless, for a veteran, but on the verge of getting homeless?
Okay. And is that your situation?
That was recently my situation.
Yeah.
You know, and I try to seek some help, but they told me I have to be homeless before I can get help. And
yeah.
I thought that was crappy.
Yeah. Steve, thanks for calling. And he's right. There are so many people who are one missed paycheck away from being on the streets.
And Steve, I empathize with you. And if we had all the resources that we needed, we would be able to have a lot more assistance prevention and making sure no one fell into homelessness. We do see this a lot. As I mentioned earlier, what we're trying to do is prioritize the people that already are homeless and get them off the streets. We do know that many people who are in a financial crisis, they never fall totally into homelessness. When we do have the resources, we do try to prevent it either through paying past due rents or utility bills, but it is an overwhelming demand in our community.
What would you say is well done to those who might be listening, and they have an open mind, but at the same time they might say, look, there's still going to be this hardcore population of guys. I see them downtown, and they don't want to go to the shelter, and they don't want to be helped. And people who say, I don't have sympathy for that segment of the homeless population.
You know, we see that. That was also the case in New York Times a few years ago, and they have been successful in moving everybody into apartments. They may not say yes to what we have to offer the first, second, or even the 10th time, but we continue to offer those services. It's not only good for them if they're able to move out, but it's also good for the entire community. We'll go back to that. You know, if you have any kind of medical ailment and you're living outside on the streets, you're going to cost the entire community a lot of money. If the sheriff's office has to arrest you, there's a cost for booking, there's a cost for staying in jail, there's a cost for the court proceedings. So there's other costs that are associated with it that are much more expensive than actually housing that person or family.
Meanwhile, lots of emails and tweets coming into the show. William writes the show, while solving homelessness is a fantastic goal, it shouldn't be put on the backs of the urban core. Since there's homeless people all over the city, when will the first homeless shelter be built in the other 700-plus square miles, not in downtown? And here are a few tweets. Lee tweets the show, there's a correlation between mental illness and homelessness that needs to be addressed, especially with our veterans. Another tweet, some cities find it cheaper and more effective to give homeless people free housing rather than to build shelters. What about those kinds of programs in Jacksonville? Lots of feedback from listeners.
Okay. I'll start with the first one first. While the shelters are located downtown, and they have been for a while, most of the housing that we provide for the homeless is not in the urban core. It is throughout all three counties in all different neighborhoods. I doubt that we will be building another shelter anytime in the foreseeable future. We have a lot of shelter beds, and the goal is to bring the total number of homeless down and just maintain what we have or reduce that. The second one, mental illness. Absolutely. This is especially difficult when it is compounded by other medical illnesses, and getting people to see any kind of doctor can be very difficult. It also makes it really hard for people to move inside sometimes and trust the help that is being offered to them. So that is something that we continue to struggle with and with our partners that deal with mental illness.
Let's go to Matt in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. I was just calling as someone who has lived in a zombie foreclosure.
Oh, okay.
I was renting for about a year, and the landlord just stopped paying a mortgage that I was giving her. While I was on an internship in L.A., so it was really complicated. But anyway, I offered to buy the house. I offered to take care of it. That none of those were options. I drive by the house all the time now because I love that house. It was like a 3,000-square-foot barn in Atlantic Beach, basically. But it was just perfect for me and all my friends and everything. We had a great time there. During college and stuff. Out of college now, I live downtown at the Carling, but it's crazy to think that I would have bought that house. I would have taken care of it. I'm a veteran, and I just see stuff like this happening all the time. It's like they're playing to these perfect storms where no one expects anything bad to happen, but then they don't allow like the normal process to happen without... They were going to make me move out first before they would even let me buy it.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of sense does that make? It's
right.
Just a bunch of crazy things.
I know. I hear you, Matt. It makes you want to beat your head against a wall. Thanks for sharing that, Matt. And, of course, as you said, Don, that's somewhat of a separate issue, but part of the overall discussion. And as people have been listening, you want volunteers for Wednesday, the annual point-in-time count.
Yes, we are doing it Wednesday, like I said, either early, when I say early in the morning, we will be gathering at 3:30 in the morning and going
oh,
up.
Oh, man.
Yes, so before anyone starts moving around downtown and in the immediate adjacent suburbs, we will be out on the streets from 4 to 6 a.m.
You're just going to go up to people, ask them their name, a little bit about themselves.
Yeah, we are actually going to use the same intake tool that we do to prioritize that we have been using since April of last year. So it not only gives the demographic information, but it prioritizes people on their vulnerability, using both their medical vulnerability, mental health, and some other factors. So we are attempting this year to survey a really high percentage of people that we meet. That is why we're asking for a lot more volunteers than we normally do.
So again, it's the annual point in time count, an annual survey of people on the streets on the First Coast. You can find the Emergency Services and Homeless Coalition's site on Facebook, or you can look for it on our website later mm-hmm. today. If you want to register to help out Wednesday, just go to wjctnews.org. Don Gilman, always great to see you, and thanks for raising awareness with us.
Thank you.
Well, later, there's actually more to talk about for this weekend's Super Bowl than just that Deflategate controversy. Culpepper will have some thoughts a little later on. But up next is today's edition of First Coast Success. Find out who's in the spotlight next.
Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about The Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
The 26th annual Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities is being held this week in the historic African-American community of Eatonville. Coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Zora's niece, Lucy Ann Hurston. We'll discuss the second Seminole War Journal of Jacob Rhett Mott and Spanish colonial era olive jars. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, she's a leading philanthropist on the First Coast in charge of administering millions in funds to local nonprofits. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record talks with Nina Waters, president of the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida.
Nina Waters is president of the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida, Incorporated, the state's oldest and largest community foundation. The foundation began 51 years ago in 1964 to serve residents of Baker, Clay, Duval, Nassau, and St. John's counties. Waters joined the foundation in 2001 after serving for 12 years as executive director for the Pace Center for Girls Jacksonville. Nina Waters, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Community Foundation is a large organization. Could you summarize how it came about and its mission?
The Community Foundation movement started actually 100 years ago on our 50th anniversary of the same year. And the movement really started in Cleveland, Ohio, when the Rockefellers decided to move to New York City and take their money with them. And so the business people in Cleveland in 1914 got together and said, individually, we cannot replace the largesse of the Rockefeller family, but collectively we can. And so that started the first community foundation. So it's the Communities Foundation. Four businessmen in Jacksonville got together in 1963 and 64 and said, we need one of those here. We became the first in Florida. We then have grown over those years. Our mission has changed somewhat, moving from being kind of a vehicle for individual people's philanthropy to be more of a community change agent. But all in all, in all of the 50 years that we've served folks, we keep the donors in the center of our work.
Why don't you give an example of one of those endowments and who might have created it and how it works?
We have endowments that are very, very specific, and then we have endowments that are very, very broad. So I'll go to the full spectrum. So the first one is one that was set up by a gentleman who lost a child, and he wanted to make sure that a light that he donated to a local church was always lit 24 hours a day. And so he established an endowment to pay the electric bill on that light to be funded in perpetuity. And then we have donors that say, I don't know in perpetuity whatever's going to happen. So they establish endowments that are called unrestricted. And they say, in perpetuity, we want the Community Foundation to respond to emerging community issues. And that's how we fund, for example, we funded public education reform for the past 10 years. And then there's all kinds of things in between. Some donors are care about aging adults. And so they set up endowments to fund that. So donors say that cared about this during my lifetime, and I want to continue my gift in perpetuity.
We hear a lot about philanthropy and how it was affected by the recession, but we also hear Jacksonville and Northeast Florida really are a very giving, it's a very giving community. What do you see in this area of philanthropy?
We are a very giving community. We're the most giving community in the state as far as the giving per capita and also the amount of giving per individual. So we have people giving about 3.8% of their assets. That makes us the sixth most generous community out of large communities in the country. But what the challenge here is we need to get more people giving. So if we had more givers giving at the rate that people give, it would be even better. That being said, I think we've been very successful as a community because we have very strong leadership at the nonprofits, and people give to people, and people invest in people. And because we have such great talent in the nonprofit sector that has really built a reputation for doing good work and quality work, I think that's really helped our sector over the past many years. The challenge is private giving can never replace public giving. And so as the city and the state have reduced funding for those organizations, the private sector really cannot pick that up.
So what happens?
So what happens is really building advocacy agendas. And so how do we as foundations and individuals, how do we advocate for the nonprofit sector? How do we explain the importance of the sector, the cost effectiveness of the sector, and what would happen? How do we paint a picture about what would happen if these organizations went out of business and indeed the government had to pick up the ball and take care of them? And that's where I think we can make the biggest difference, is really investing in advocacy as a field.
What advice do you have for people who do have money to give, despite how much they may have? How do they develop that thought process of where do I put my money to do good?
Well, the first thing is that I think that people should give their time first and their money second. And so there are so many things that people have to give that have nothing to do with money. And financial capital usually is the last form of giving that people do. So I think it's important to figure out where to jump into the pool and where to get engaged. The other thing is, you can teach philanthropy beginning with your children, with your young children. And so let your children see that you give and engage them in that and talk to them about it. And try to figure out a way to say, we're going to give you X amount of money a year to give, or we're going to use so much of your allowance, or how do you teach that next generation to give? What we're seeing, which is a little bit frightening, is that next generation is really doing a lot of international giving because they're really, with the internet and with technology, they're really in tune to needs in other communities, and they're not really in tune to needs in their own community because maybe they haven't seen those things or been exposed to those things, or their parents don't talk to them about what they're doing to support the community. And so I think we've got to really help them understand that the arts are important and the environment is important and education and safety net services are important, and expose them to that at a much younger age. I would say that I do a lot of talking to donors about ways to give, but I think I learn much more from donors, from their giving and observing that. It's been a really rich experience for me.
You grew up in Pittsburgh, and I heard you speak to the Girl Scouts of Gateway Council when you were named a Woman of Distinction, and that was in 2008. And you talked about your childhood and how it influenced your career, and you had some great tips. Can you share that?
Sure. So I was really blessed to be brought up in an Italian Catholic family, a very extended family. And my family had a grocery business. And I began working at the store when I was 8. My father, grandfather, grandmother, and uncle all worked there. I began working then, and I worked all the way through high school, and then when I came back for college. And I think I learned a lot there. It's a very high-touch business. Customers had charge accounts. I had a lot of responsibility at a young age. I got to watch, you know, my father in action. And I have this sort of top 10 list that I share when I talk to emerging leaders, and I'll just share a few. The first one is that business is always good, and I talk about that at the foundation. One time a customer came into the store and said, "Nina, how are things going?" I said, "We're kind of slow today." And then my father took me aside when they left, and they said, "Business is always good. Customers want to be in a successful or work, you know, come to a successful organization." And so I think that was a really good lesson. And so at the foundation, we talk about that too, that people want to give to successful organizations. The other one that I think is important too is that people work with you and not for you. We have a we mentality and not a me mentality at the Community Foundation. I've worked for people that have said, "My staff, my this, my that." It's very off-putting. None of us are successful alone, and you're only good as the people you surround yourself with. So I really believe strongly that you know, people work with you. Don't stand around. My grandfather, when I was younger, and I'd, you know, stop when we weren't busy and eat a grape, or, you know, talk to one of the other workers at the grocery store, he'd say, "Nina, don't stand around." You know, and that means there's always something to do. And it's kind of a way to teach initiative. And so you can always dust the shelves or move the stock forward or check bills or whatever it is you need to do, but don't be idle. And I think that's really important and has served me really well. And the last thing is, I've learned to embrace change. Things change within the business world, and you need to constantly examine your business model and think about how to staff the organization or what needs to change. Sometimes it's not the organization that needs to change. Sometimes you need to change. And so it's been very helpful for me to think about that change is really a good thing.
Well, Nina Waters, president of the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
And make sure to read a transcript of Karen's talk with Nina Waters in today's Daily Record. Up next, Rizzoli and Isles author Tess Gerritsen will tell you where you can meet her today in town. Plus, a Super Bowl preview with Cole Pepper. Back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a measles outbreak centered in California has sickened more than 70 people and is still spreading. Why some families are opting out of vaccines and what it means for public health across the country.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, best-selling suspense writer Tess Gerritsen is in town this week. Gerritsen is the author of those wildly popular Rizzoli and Isles novels that inspired TNT's hit television series. I spoke with her about what inspired the characters.
I wrote the first book with Jane Rizzoli. It was called The Surgeon. She was the sidekick of the main character, and I have every intention of killing her off in that story. But she survived, and then I introduced more Isles in the following book, and by the third book, I realized these two women were so interesting, I wanted to keep following their lives. And over the course of these 11 books, they've become very good friends. It was very organic development.
That's Tess Gerritsen, and she appears tonight at the downtown Jacksonville Main Library. Tess will give a free talk about her fascinating crime-fighting characters. Don't miss it. It's tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the library's Hicks Auditorium. And finally this hour, it's Super Bowl week.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Our own Cole Pepper is here now, but not to talk about Deflategate, because Cole says you've probably heard enough about that by now. Hi, Cole.
Yeah, there has been a bit of conversation here and there.
Just a little bit.
I mean, anytime something in the NFL goes from being talked about on ESPN and Sports Talk Radio to being talked about on CNN and Fox News, suddenly it has... I don't know if jump the shark is quite the right term for it, but it's certainly taken it to the next level.
Work in references to Happy Days and Mayor Alvin Brown all in one sentence.
It's just what I do, Melissa.
It's the special talents of Cole. All right, so but there is more to talk about, the actual game.
Yeah, and let's talk about this matchup between the Patriots and the Seahawks. Super Bowl 49 in Glendale, Arizona. Sometimes a Super Bowl is driven by storylines. Sometimes it's driven by a great matchup that can create a great game. I think we have a chance to have both here. We know that we're going to have some terrific storylines, and here are some of them. The Seahawks are trying to become the first repeat champions since the Patriots did it 10 years ago. That happened in Jacksonville, by the way, when the Patriots beat the Philadelphia Eagles. Tom Brady is trying to join Joe Montana and Terry Bradshaw as the only starting quarterbacks to win 4 Super Bowls.
Right. Pretty small club.
Very small and elite club. Not that Brady needs to do anything for his legacy. He's already going to go down in history as one of the great quarterbacks ever. If he wins the 4th, it would certainly give him a very strong argument, at least to be in the conversation as greatest quarterback of all time. After all, we judge quarterbacks largely on Super Bowl rings, statistics as well. So the Peyton Mannings and Dan Marinos of the world have some solace, but largely it's about championships.
Uh-huh.
The Seahawks head coach, Pete Carroll, he was the Patriots head coach before Bill Belichick. There's a little bit of a tie-in there. Carroll did not have the kind of success in New England as he has had in Seattle. And there could be plenty of trash talking as well. Seattle's vociferous cornerback, Richard Sherman, is known to jaw, as are just about all the Seattle receivers. And other than when he's talking or not talking to the media, Seahawks running back Marshawn Lynch has been rather demonstrative of late.
And, you know, Sherman's interesting because, and he made some really valid points a while back when he gave some really unvarnished opinions and was called a thug.
Yeah.
And he made the comment that you don't necessarily apply that term to my white colleagues when they trash talk.
Well, and Sherman is a very interesting guy. He maybe the best cornerback in the National Football League. If it's not him, it might be Darrell Revis, who plays for the New England Patriots. But he's a great cornerback, great cover man, but has this very sort of outspoken hip-hop approach, and he's a Stanford man. So he's a lot of interesting layers to Richard Sherman, that's for sure. And I would say that, by and large, this isn't a matchup of two particularly likable teams. You know, the Patriots.
Agreed.
Yeah. Unless you're a fan of one of these teams specifically, if you're a Jaguars fan or a fan of some other team, you don't look at these guys and go, "Boy, that's somebody I can really get behind." By and large,
nobody's an underdog in this.
Well, and there's no underdog to speak of. Belichick is as charming as an eel, to quote the Grinch. They have this cheating reputation going back to Spygate and the questions with the footballs. Now, Tom Brady is married to Brazilian supermodel Giselle, and he's got $1 jillion, so it's tough to feel you got a pull for him.
Yeah, I think people are a little tired of that whole thing.
Well, nobody thinks that Tom Brady needs something good to happen in his life at this point, just to prop him up. Russell Wilson, the Seattle quarterback, seems to be a very engaging chap, though, and maybe something there. And certainly, he has a lot of his legacy at stake here.
Sure,
he's a young quarterback, but if he wins back-to-back Super Bowls, well, that hasn't happened too many times. I think just 7 quarterbacks have won back-to-back Super Bowls, so this would be really start to boost him in terms of his legacy in the National Football League. And then, of course, there are the commercials.
And that's my favorite part.
And I'm interested to see. We've seen a transition. I'll play amateur commercial analyst here. $4.5 million for a 30-second spot, by the way.
Is that a record?
That's a record. It goes up every year because the ratings are huge and the whole bit. But how companies utilize those, it's not just putting an ad out there. It's trying to create a whole campaign around it leading up to it and using that as sort of the fulcrum point.
And the social media afterwards is almost more important now than the ad that plays in real time.
And most of the time you can see most of these spots beforehand on YouTube or somewhere else. So there's not a lot of drama to that standpoint. Anyhow, we'll certainly have a chance. I know you'll probably have plenty to talk about with the Super Bowl commercials on Monday next week.
And we actually will have someone. Yes. Yeah, coming in to talk about them. Yeah.
So, all right, here's my pick. This is a tough game to pick because these are two very good teams, arguably top team in the AFC, top team in the NFC all year. I'm taking Seattle 26, New England 24 to win it, and I think New England misses a potential game-winning field goal because the ball is uninflated enough.
I just got an idea just now. You know how the late Roger Ebert, every year at the Oscars, he had his Outguess Ebert competition?
Yes, yeah.
We need to come up with one where people, outguess Cole.
It's not very hard. I will tell you, my track record is not fantastic, as any Ohio State fan will remind you from the national championship
game.
That
would be an easy prize for our listeners.
Yeah, something to win. Or at least, a pat on the back and a laurel and hearty handshake.
And maybe you could give them some barbecue. That could be their prize.
There you go.
Some famous Culpepper barbecue sauce.
Yeah. All right, so closer to home and off the football field, they ran the Rolex 24 at Daytona Saturday and Sunday. A star-studded team that included NASCAR drivers Jamie McMurray and Kyle Larson, as well as Indy 500 winner Tony Kanaan, and 3-time IndyCar champ Scott Dixon, beat the competition by 1.33 seconds after racing for 24 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. I mean, that's like winning a marathon in a photo finish.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
Incredible.
And they actually, the reason they were able to win, there's a rule that only one driver can only be in the car a maximum of 14 out of the 24 hours.
Uh-huh.
And the team that was leading was out in front of that all-star team, and he hit his 14-hour mark with like 30 minutes to go. So,
what kind of endurance do you have to have?
I don't know. A lot of coffee and Red Bull, probably.
Exactly.
I know the feeling sometimes. We're less than 2 weeks away from the inaugural match for the Jacksonville Armada. Saturday, February 7th, the Armada faced the Philadelphia Union of the MLS at Everbank Field in a preseason friendly. Third straight year that the Union has come to Jacksonville for a preseason match. And I talked with Philly midfielder Danny Cruz last week, who told me that he has seen Jacksonville grow as a soccer town each year.
They're definitely making a name for themselves, literally, and that's great. It's great for the city, it's great for the fans, and for the organization. It's going to continue to grow. You have to start somewhere, and I think they're starting off on a great foot, especially with this game.
And it would be interesting to see. We're told that Philly will play their starters most of the game, a predominance of the game. Uh-huh. And so this should be a good test, and we'll have a good litmus test to see where the Armada is as a club as they put this thing together here in the early stages. They play their inaugural match and then the regular season opener as well, both at Everbank Field. That's April 4th. Rest of the home matches will be played at Community First Park at the baseball grounds.
And make sure to catch Cole on TV. You will be calling the Armada games on the CW.
That's right, as well as our Friday night preview show every Friday night at 11.
Always great to see you. Follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. This program's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback for us, we want to hear it. Just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They are now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, a measles outbreak centered in California has sickened more than 70 people, and it's still spreading. Why some families are opting out of vaccines and what it means for public health. That conversation is next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.